Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 525. And I adored recording this episode. I'm joined today by Josie Long. And coming off of this conversation, it just set me up so beautifully for the day, right? It's weird with this podcast. I've been doing it. I love this podcast. I love recording them. I love the conversations I have. But I have been doing it. I've put out an episode once a week, every week for like 9 years. So it does just become a thing at times. It does just become work in moments. And let me explain that. Like, I booked in this conversation with Josie about a month or two before we recorded it. And it was just on the calendar. I'm like, right, yeah, I'm talking to Josie on Tuesday. I've got this, I've got that, I've got this and that. And as I've said before, I do my prep quite late. And that's intentional because I want it all fresh in my head. So I was prepping for this probably the day before or maybe the day before that. And as soon as I started to prep, I started to get so excited to talk to Josie. I'm sure we all have people in our lives who maybe, I guess, like Josie is someone I've got so much love and admiration for as a person and as an artist. Yet we don't interact that much. And Josie probably isn't aware. Like I was going to say, we probably all have people in our lives who have impacted us in ways that they won't realise. And when I was at a really early point in my career, Josie really inspired me and fired me up and yeah, was just a really positive person to know of the existence of, if you know what I mean. And that's been across the years, and particularly, I mean, we touch upon it here, there's in a few moments, particularly with social media and podcasts and whatever else, we can be passively being inspired by or really keeping up to date with someone and they'll never know. Like there's a few points where I mention my absolute adoration of Josie and Josie's output. And she seems quite genuinely surprised. It didn't occur to me. It's like, oh yeah, I'm listening to podcasts. I'm watching on socials. I'm not particularly letting you know. And I kind of just want to, you know, have a listen to this episode. And when it's done, maybe let someone know, you know. Do you know what I mean? Whether that's, you know, someone who you're a fan of and you don't know in day-to-day life, or whether it's a real family person, a friend or whatever else. A family person, a family member. A friend or whatever else, like reach out and let those people know that they're special to you, you know. This was a lovely chat and I think you're going to really enjoy it. It goes all over the place. We both interrupt each other a lot. We both talk over each other a lot and I wouldn't want it any other way. It really illustrates our excitement. And I'd hedge to bet that, is that a phrase? That Josie had the same as me, that Josie had this podcast on the schedule for a while and was just like, oh, it'd be cool to chat to Pip. And then when we both started, we both just got really excited and remembered how lovely it is to catch up. You know, it's cool. It's a really good chat. I need to announce something. So this is coming out on August 2nd, right? So if you're listening to this on August 2nd, I've got something really important to tell you. So as I record this, it's not actually announced yet, but this isn't coming out till then. On August 3rd, a lot of you will know I always release something. It started with Introdiction, which I released on my 30th birthday, and I always kind of put out either a new bit of merch or just something. I always do something on my birthday, and this year I'm really excited about it. A lot of you know I don't do music anymore. I've got no plans to ever return to music or playing live, but I'm really proud of it all. I really enjoyed all of those days. It meant the world to me. So I've spent the last month or so editing together a live film, but filmed by you guys. So I've spent so long trawling YouTube and hard drives and all sorts of other stuff for any footage I've got of me and Dan, of my solo stuff. And what I did, I then wrote out a playlist of what my, if I was to do a gig, what I would do. And then I've tried to find all the songs for that and edit it all together as this live show. And then Buddy Peace has gone through and kind of mixed and mastered it a bit to make it sound as good as possible. And then on August 3rd, Thursday night, at 7 p.m, I'm going to be airing it on my Twitch. So I'm doing it like a gig. Doors are going to be at 7. There's going to be a support act at 7:30. And there's going to be the main show around 8. In between these things, I'm going to be chatting to you guys, answering questions. It's all free. It's free entry. After the gig finishes, I'll hang around and answer any questions and talk about those days and those years. But I'm super excited about it. It was an idea I came up with and thought, oh, this could be cool. And then when I started editing all together, oh man, it was a buzz. Like, The thing I loved was I found some footage that was professionally recorded and I didn't end up using it because it didn't have the same vibe as some of the phone recorded stuff. Once you kind of tweak it a bit to make the sound more bearable. Obviously, there's loads of stuff out there that wasn't usable at all. But yeah, I'm really excited. And the idea that everyone watching it is watching it live, right? So I'm not going to upload it to YouTube or anything. It's just going to be Thursday the 3rd of August on my Twitch channel. So yeah, come along to that. I feel like I've plugged everything there. As ever, we're brought to you by speechdevelopmentoracles.com. That's where you can buy my merch. twitch.tv/ScroobiusPipio is where you can come and hang out, chat, watch me do stuff, screen stuff, all that kind of thing. And patreon.com/ScroobiusPip is where you can support the podcast for about $1 a month or $2 a month. And that really makes a difference. Yeah, let's get into this episode because it's, as I said, it's a joy. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 525 with Josie Long. I'm here today with Josie Long, and I've rushed us into recording here because we've not caught up in so long. And this is honestly the least I've prepared for a podcast because I've just been really excited about talking to you and catching up. So it's going to be very informal and just... So yeah, let's start off. How are you? How's your morning been? What's been going on? You've just got back from holiday, I hear.
Yeah, we got back a little while ago, but it's, yeah, my morning was like this. It was my normal morning routine, which is both my children wake me up at 7 a.m.
Yeah.
My partner goes for a nap because he's doing the nights with the baby at the moment because my children are terrible sleepers. And what happens is one of my babies comes and like breastfeeds and then bites me really hard every time.
Right.
And even though I've been watching Instagram the whole time and been like, what you do is you say to them, don't bite me. Let's get you something else to bite. And she's 19, 20 months. And she was like, no. And I was like, oh God. So she does that. And then we've got one of those Pickler triangles. That's like a climbing frame that we bought in the lockdown. Yes. And they both have a go on that while I like try and wake up. And then I made pancakes, which was good.
Amazing.
And then my daughter went out to her outdoor kindergarten, which she's about to finish, which is genuinely heartbreaking because all she does is play in the woods and she's about to go to school. And I just feel like it's going to be brutal for her.
Yeah, that beautiful version where you're going and adventuring and then into how our education systems are, where it's far from adventuring. Yeah, that's sad.
Wearing a uniform, staying in a classroom all day.
Yeah.
But hopefully it will be... sweet and he's going. And then my little one is off with her babysitter today. And that was my morning.
I love your morning. How do you find the overwhelming amount of advice out there now for mums on Instagram and TikTok and all these other things? Because again, all of those things, they're so personal and so individual. So I've known people who felt really kind of overwhelmed by it all because it's saying, oh, here's what you do. And then you try that and it doesn't work. And you're like, why aren't I like the Instagram person or the TikTok person? Why aren't I? What's wrong with me? What's wrong with my kids?
Yeah, it is interesting. I think in some ways it's been incredibly helpful. Like I follow a lot of accounts that are like conscious parenting, like nice, don't be a prick to your kids. And they're all just like a very gentle American woman being like, how about just treating your kid respectfully? You're like, cool, great, nice. Or like infographics that are like, here's what to do. And sometimes I find it very helpful. And other times, I don't know. I think I've got a strong chance that my children are going to be neurodivergent because both their parents are. Mm-hmm. And so like a lot of times I'll be like, this would be so good advice if my child didn't have like screaming sensory reactions to having their hair brushed.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. I guess I don't think I'm somebody that's like totally, oh, I wish I had their life. I wish I was like them. And sometimes I think it's almost the opposite. When I see people whose account is like, what will mummy play this afternoon? I'm like, mummy needs to stop making things for show.
Yeah. Live your life.
Live your life.
I love it though. But it, I mean, how have you found having your second child? Does it feel, do you feel more experienced and you know what you're doing, or is it completely different challenges? Because again, because of all different childs, all different kinds of neurodivergence and stuff like that, it's...
And they're all different. Yeah, this is that thing, isn't it? Where like, I used to be like, well, firstly, everyone's different, sure. The second baby, absolutely game changer, all that. But I used to be like, wow, how can two children with the same parents in the same household be so different? And now I'm like, because they don't have the same parents. Me at 36 and me at 39 are two very different people. Like when I was 36, I had a lot more energy. And also, they really do have completely, not completely, but quite different experiences of that early parenting. Like when I had my first daughter, I was just scared of everything. Yeah, and when I had my second one, I was like, ah, she's fine. And as a result, my second daughter was like the most adventurous. So we call her Danger Mouse because she's terrifying. Like you turn your back and she'll like have climbed up something and be laughing at you.
Yeah.
Just like, ha, you didn't think I could do this, but here I am. You're like, ah, why? But I found it second time around very beautiful, very lovely first year. And now it's like utterly overwhelming, but in a good way. It's nice. Yeah. So it's been good. I do love having kids. I really do. And I like the fact that it's like I was ready to do it and I really want to like dive into it and like get the most out of that experience.
Yeah. Oh, that's a beautiful thing. I think timing can be everything on that. And everyone often says, you might not think you're ready, but you'll be ready. I know loads of people who didn't just find they were ready. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of, it's, I think it's really good to go, oh no, I've decided this, and I'm, rather than rely on the, oh, it'll all kick in or this or that. It's like, no, you've gone, right, here's the time.
This is what I want to do.
I'm ready to jump into this.
How are you? I know it's your podcast, so you probably get to talk, but I want to see how you are.
I'm good. And that's kind of what I noted was you were last on this podcast in 2015. So, so much has changed for both of us since then. Oof. I've stopped doing music and I'm doing acting and film right now. You've written a film.
I love seeing you in that.
You've moved to Scotland. There's so much going on. So we've got a lot to catch up on, Josie. But I'm good. In general, I'm good. I'm going through the, and I won't go into it in huge detail, but I'm going through the process at the moment of trying to get a film made. And I know you've been there and I know how exciting and heartbreaking within a day it can be. You can have a moment where you're like, this is the best thing in the world. Everyone, it's going to happen. And then you'll have something else that you're like, oh my God, I'm a piece of shit. people from working class areas of Essex who have stammers aren't meant to be the leads in films they've written, stuff like that. There's so many ups and downs. 100% they are. I'm on the up at the moment. So yeah, damn right. It's all working, but it's a hell of a journey, isn't it? And you kind of went through that with your film in 2018, right?
Yeah, we did. Well, we actually made it in 2016. We had a, it was an interesting thing. And I could really see some ways that it really worked out for us and some ways that I could see, for me personally, I could have done it better. I worked with a director called Douglas King and he's amazing. And he did so much on it. And it was just so impressive what he managed to do with nothing. Like we were both very impatient because we started making short films in 2011. And we just had this like, I don't want to say arrogance, but like arrogance that we were like, we'll just be making a feature next year. We made two shorts.
Tell
we
sort me of didn't about it.
Appreciate how hard it is or how, I don't know. And also like a lot of people who do get things funded, get it funded from like family money. Do you know what I mean? So you can see some people, you think, wow, they done really well. And then you look and you're like, oh, their parents funded their
first
film.
Here's how it happened.
Yeah. And then what happened was my great aunt passed away at the age of 96. Very good genes. And she left me £3,000. It was like winning a thing on Monopoly. It was amazing. Yeah. And I was just like, do you know what? Also because there was like a family feud around the money. And I thought, I'm going to use this to make our film because I don't know when else I'm just going to get a windfall in my life.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is it. I'm going to use it. And so we decided to see if we can make it for that little money and see how we could still kind of pay people but do it on the tightest thing. And so it just meant that Doug did about three jobs unpaid. I did about three jobs at the moment. But the way it came together was we sat down and we were like, how can we make this under these limitations and how can we get it made in the best way. And we decided if we did a week's shooting before and after a summer, that would be easier to kind of get people than trying to do 2 weeks, where 2 weeks is quite a long time to take out of commitments and stuff.
Yeah.
So we did, we planned that. And then we were like, well, why don't we make it before and after a breakup? We're like, great, great, great. And then I was like, why don't we put a military coup in the middle of it? And so it's people trying to live their lives around the kind of right-wing, far-right military coup before and after. And I wanted to make it, I think, because it was like to sort of highlight, I think it's a bit clumsy, but to talk about the fact that people assume that their safety and security is like an intrinsic part of who they are and not just like absolute luck as to where they are and stuff. And so, like, I wanted to talk about that a little bit. And also just talk about the fact that details of life don't stop even under difficult circumstances, and that people's friendships aren't not full of humour under difficult circumstances and, like, stuff like that. So that was, like, my weird motivation. But it was, my problem was that I think if I'd had more time and perhaps, like, a good script editor, the script would have been 1,000 times better. A lot of it was, like, on the hoof, not able to draft as much as I would have liked. And so now I look back and I think that's where, if we'd have money, it would have been a much better film. And that's where I sort of feel I fucked up a bit. But
Shane Meadows has got a lot to answer for. I know when I was making, like, short films, independent films, I was like, oh, we'll improvise it. That's what Shane Meadows does. It'll be fine. We'll have a loose script. It's like, oh, no, he's a genius. When me and my mates are improvising it, it's not quite there. So you need to, I need to get harder on the script. And,
well, for us, we had a thing where we had all these actors and we had to be as flexible as we could be. So there were some people who just physically could not do the second block of shooting. There's a soap opera in Scotland called River City. I don't even know if it's still going, but basically loads of our actors got stolen by River City.
Amazing.
We were like, oh, fuck. So we had to rewrite lots of the second half just before shooting. So it sort of became the film that we could make. And then I remember once we'd finished filming and Doug was, and me, I was staying with Doug during it and we were driving back to his and it was like 11:30 at night. And he said, oh, by the way, we're supposed to be shooting the scene outside McDonald's tomorrow, but we're not going to be able to do that. Like, we won't be able to shoot at McDonald's. We won't be able to do this. So we're going to have to completely rewrite it. And it was like, it's 11:30 at night. We're starting at 6 a.m. So we were just like, what happens? Where? So there was a lot of that.
That's
and
mad.
In some ways, yeah, but it was super exciting. And the end thing I'm really proud of, and especially of Doug, like, I think he edited it, he directed it, and the work he did was amazing. And and I was just proud to get to do it. And I really loved working with, we had an actor called James Kirk, who's like one of the most underrated funny people in the world. And then we did it. We were like, oh, I don't know if any traction's going to happen. And for a while, it just wasn't quite, we were like, oh no, it's not quite coming together. It's not, nothing's going to happen. We were like, oh, look, you know, we did this for nothing. We're proud of it. If it doesn't have much of a life, we did do it. And then really, really amazingly and luckily, it got nominated for a British Independent Film Award for their kind of experimental category. And then we were able to tour it in cinemas. Yeah, it did all right in the end. For a £3,000 film, I'm like, it couldn't have gone better.
Yeah, it's astounding. It's amazing. How was that to get to go? Again, I guess it's weird. I think it turning up in the cinemas would have been a goal initially, but to have had that moment where you kind of accept it's not going to happen and then have it happen, did that feel all the more special and amazing that you'd kind of written
so
it off
good.
As an option that you're like, oh, there you go. Because if it had just gone straight in cinemas, you would have gone, well, yeah, it's a film. We made a film.
Here we are.
That's what happens.
Yeah.
But because you had that moment of, well, there you go. We did our best. And then people turn around and go, oh, no, it's really good. You did great.
Yeah, that was wonderful. Yeah, it was. And do you know what? I think human beings love a narrative, don't they? Also, I feel like I just talked to you for about 10 minutes, like, and then this happened, and then I did this, and I'm sorry.
No,
so I hope any of us can hear it.
I love it. I think it's really interesting that you were making a film about how people should realise that they're maybe in a position of comfort and bad things could happen to them out of their control, that you were filming that in 2016, when then the world went fucking mental and we had Brexit and America had Trump and every great celebrity died and everything else just
I have
went
to
mad.
Tell you about this. The first week of shooting, the last day of it was the Brexit vote.
Wow.
And I stayed up all night the last day of shooting because me and Sean, who's one of the actors, were like, we'll just stay up and you've got to leave at 5 in the morning. We'll just have like a nice like end of block like hang out, and it was really nice. And I left at like 5 a.m. I was like, I'll sleep on the train. And I did not sleep on the train. And the train was full of people loudly talking over me. Literally, there was a woman there and a man there about how they voted Brexit and how great it was. And I was emotional. And I was like, listen to me, don't forget me. You've stolen my children's future.
Yeah.
Which, can I just say, I didn't start the conversation, so I felt allowed to be that melodramatic. But yeah, there was that, and then got home, voted, and obviously that happened. And then we'd shot the last of it in November, and the last day of shooting then was when Trump was elected. And we really did feel like we'd created a cursed project where we had summoned chaos.
Yeah, that's madness. The two biggest fuck-ups, essentially, of recent times coincided with the ending of each of your blocks. That's insane. Obviously, I said you were on in 2015. We bumped into each other once or twice, but not loads. But I know we talked a few times. I think it was just before you moved up to Scotland. What made you move to Scotland? Was it purely to make the Fringe more affordable? Because no one can actually play the Fringe anymore. But yeah, what was the motivation for the move? Because I don't want to preempt anything, kind of.
No, I've been wanting to move up for a really long time. When I met Doug, he's my friend, the filmmaker, that was in about 2011. And he's from Clydebank, which is just outside Glasgow, and was based in Glasgow. And so I'd be going up there to work with him. At the time, I was going out with someone who's from Glasgow, so we'd be around a bit. And I met my friends who are, they're basically mainly, or they were at the time, Edinburgh-based. Mm. But there was just something about Glasgow that the more I went there, the happier I was. And I would just be like, and I've got a really good friend here, Henry, who lives around the corner from me now, or who I live around the corner from, because I've moved into his neighbourhood. And yeah, it was just one of those things whenever I, especially this neighbourhood where I live now, I just be like, why am I so happy here? Like, why does this make me so happy? And then that was like 2010, 2011, 2012. And then in like about 2013 or 2014, I wrote a whole radio sitcom about me moving to Glasgow to try and like manifest it.
I love it.
And then it just still took me years and years. And then my partner, Johnny, I think it took me a little while to like persuade him to get here. And then it took us a while to be able to like, I think as well, London's a cult. And if you've bought into it, you can't ever imagine yourself leaving.
Yeah.
And I love London, but I didn't feel like I could have a quality of life. Like I was just renting the smallest flat that even was too small for me, Johnny, and my daughter. And I also just didn't, I felt like it was making me feel embittered because I kept thinking about, all right, so I'll go to this primary school up the road and half the parents will be these like owners of gigantic houses. And I'll feel really like, I don't know, like maybe saying that sounds a bit like sad. I just found it, it wasn't about like jealousy of things. It was just a bit like, if there's any way that I can try and find a way for a happier life, I thought I should take it. And I love the culture in Glasgow and I wanted to live in Scotland. And I was just like, why don't I just try and do it?
I completely understand it. I think I've had family from Edinburgh and a lot of friends in Glasgow. And again, number one,
you're a cool guy. You're going to know people in Glasgow. You're a cool guy.
I do my best. But again, I think it's an amazing place. And just what you were speaking about there of trying to find small ways to give yourself a happier life, something I've found with my Scottish mates during all the political stuff in recent years, from the Tories getting in and doing damage before we even knew that Brexit was on its way. It was a depressing enough time before that. And it can really affect you. And as weird as it is, all my Scottish mates, as much as they're probably affected in the same way on the grand scale, they could sit there and go, that's you lot. That's you for fucking idiots down there. It's affecting all of us, but you fucking did it and it's not on me. Whereas when you're in it, you're like, well, I didn't vote that, but it is the area I'm in. Like the area I'm in Essex is a big voter of the Conservatives or worse, if they can find it. UKIP and all sorts of stuff have done amazing round like, here. So
Can we talk about that? Because I feel like, definitely. I did move as well. Like I talk about it on stage a bit about after the 2019 election, I did feel a bit like, right, okay. So this thing that I really hoped for us in terms of positive change and stuff has been so soundly rejected. I obviously am at odds here. and it would be better for me to move somewhere that I feel the political culture is slightly different. Definitely. Yeah. But
I'm conscious because we're talking about parenthood and politics and all that, I'm conscious of just not making you perform tender for me, because I came and saw that and loved it. So I'm really trying So this is, you did this because of this. It's like, I'll let you go anywhere you want to go.
But Pullman is part of it. But what I was going to say is, where did you grow up? Was it Southend?
No, Stamfordly Hope. Like the house I live in now is 5 minutes up the road from where my mum lives, where I was born and lived in that house, and 5 minutes up the road from where my dad lives in the opposite direction. So I've lived in this same small town my whole life. And it's a weird one, because I was tempted to move to London a few times. Part of it that put me off was just being working class and looking at and the logic of going, right, so I could rent where I am or in London and it would cost me five times as much and I'd have nothing and all this. But part of it was also, when I was looking at moving into London, it was moving kind of East London where all the artists are and all this. And I felt even that it wasn't, I've mentioned this a few times and it sounds so wanky, but particularly at the time, as a poet or as a writer or as a social commentator, I felt I couldn't go to like a fake utopia where it seems like everything's all right and it's not. In fact, one of the stories I tell that sums it up perfectly, you're a part of and you don't know. One of the gigs I did for Robin Ince, and you were there, and I think it was the one The Cure were there and Coogan were there.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
All sorts of amazing people. And I got to do a bit of spoken word at the start. And then I just sat in one of the aisles and watched all of these idols of mine. And I got the train home that night. And if there's ever a moment that you're going to start to get an ego, it's when you're sharing the stage with The Cure and Steve Coogan and all of these.
Yeah,
and
not
Brian
a big deal,
Cox.
Just very.
And all these. But I got the train home that night. And three girls from Tilbury tried to steal my shoes and set fire to my beard. So if there's ever anything that's going to keep you humble and keep you grounded, go, oh no, I'm just the big weird bearded guy. That's all it is, kind of thing. So again, I did feel there was some importance of staying around
balanced
normal people, like outside of the artistic world, kind of thing.
I do know what you mean. Like I think if you're somebody that cares about like society and people and inequality, the goal is not to no longer be normal.
Yeah.
The goal is not to absent yourself so much that you live in a mansion and you aren't still affected by everything that's going on. That having been said, I think that's complicated, because every now and again you sort of go, no, maybe I should just try and be very wealthy or something, and then it doesn't work. I don't know. But I think, the thing I was going to say for me is, like, I'm from Orpington in Kent. Well, I said it, and I'm from St. Mary Cray, which is like a smaller part of Orpington, but I've always just said Orpington. And it's been something that I've been thinking a lot about, how at odds with it I felt in terms of it being a very small seat and a very big seat conservative place, and how I never felt that. Even before I felt like I had any politics, I always felt like I hate the kind of unspoken, know your place, like, don't do things differently. How dare you? You're embarrassing us. Shut up. Sort of vibe. And so, like, it's something where I think I always felt like I didn't quite fit in, but at the same time, then my inclination would have been to just like slag it off, and actually that's not cool at all when I think about the history of it, where there used to be like radical socialist publishers in Orpington, and I think about like in Essex where there was like so many different counterculture music scenes, counterculture poetry scenes, like so much culture, and like I just feel like I'll never not have this like uneasy relationship with it.
Right.
Where on one hand, I feel like I just don't fit in at all. And on the other hand, I'm like looking for the fact that there were always people there who I would have a massive kinship with and stuff.
Yeah.
But
it's a weird balance, isn't it? And again, I contradict myself in that it's not like I've stayed here and I'm out arguing with people about politics all the time and winning people over and convincing people of the truth. I'm staying in my little house and keeping myself to myself. But yeah, it's a weird one. It's interesting to hear of your kind of conflicts and struggles with where you're from, with who you are when you, who you are where you're from, if you know what I mean, where who you are fits with where you're from and all that. Because as I was prepping this, I made a note, because I'm not sure I've ever told you, but you've always been a huge inspiration to me, because back in 2006 or so, when we'd gig together, and we were roughly the same age, but you were a veteran of the scene. So I was up there kind of going,
how do I present someone that I think they want to like, or things like that. And it felt like you'd get up and be you. Like, we did a few gigs together in a row, and I swear you tried to do the same set each gig, but there was rarely anything that crossed over, because you'd just be so...
Wow.
It'd feel like you're so
distracted.
Comfortable up there. Yeah, oh, that's it. You're so... But that's it. There is distracted, but also just so comfortable to go, oh, what's going on today? Like, let's go in that direction. And it was always a massive inspiration. So it's interesting to hear of any conflict over who you are or where you stand.
Do you know what? I feel like everything in my life some days can be explained by undiagnosed neurodivergence. Oh, you saying, oh, you were sort of yourself on stage. I think for better or for worse, I can only do what I can do. I've never been somebody who's been able to go, what do the crowd want? How do I do it?
Yeah.
How do I plan in a long-term way to create things to work in XYZ? For me, it's quite like a heater or something. It's like it's on or it's not. Or like I'm interested or I'm not. And when I'm interested, I'm desperately interested. And when I'm not, and in some ways it's deeply frustrating. And in some ways I can see why that makes me like odd or niche or whatever, because I don't know, I'm just not able necessarily to play the game very well. I feel like I fuck it up all the time.
Yeah.
And it's the same with like, then I look back at my childhood and where I grew up, and I think is one of the reasons I felt at odds just because I had ADHD and nobody knew it. And so I was the whole time just like, this doesn't seem right for me.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, Blind Boy talks about it a lot on his podcast about neurodivergence and about finding not the place where you can cope, but the place for your particular neurodivergence to thrive. And for you, it is on stage. And for Blind Boy, it is like his podcast and that, because he does these deep dives into just the weirdest of subjects.
Yes,
that used to be a problem.
Indulge.
Like, yeah. Like, that used to be a problem in his U4 at school, because he'd meant to be working in an office and then he'd spend 8 hours looking at the history of fish fingers or something. Whereas now he can do that and then put out an amazing hour-long podcast of the history of fish fingers. It's like, it's now what makes him great. It's not what once held him, what in one situation held him back, in another situation just absolutely makes him thrive. So I find all that stuff fascinating.
Yeah, it's lucky, isn't it? Do you feel, I feel lucky to have found performing, because I do think I'm quite awkward in real life. And then on stage, I just don't feel it. I feel safe and happy and excited and just able to just go for it.
And you can steer into any of it. I know, I remember recording, at the end of each year on this podcast, I do a drunk cast, and it's with just two of my oldest mates. So we go round to his shed and we get drunk and we record for hours. And I remember one year turning up there in a sleeveless denim jacket and hadn't thought about it. I'd been wearing it loads. I love it. Perfectly comfortable. And I walked in and they rinsed me for ages, because they were like, oh no, you're not Scroobius Pip here. because you're used to that comfort. And again, I think that's the same thing. On stage, you can have that comfort because they're here to see me and they're accepting of me. Therefore, I can be my full self. Whereas sometimes in social situations, you're not that. You have to be that. You're there as just someone in the room, and you feel you have to adapt to how they feel you should be. And
yes, that's so interesting.
I kind of like both. I like both. I like having mates who will dig me out and go, what the fuck are you doing? And I'll fight back. I go, no, I love this. This is my favourite jacket. You're all dickheads. But it's a good
balance, isn't it? It's a tricky... All of life, man. All of life is a tricky balance. And I think I'm sometimes quite an all or nothing person. And so the real challenge for me is to try and ever be consistent. And the thing that I'm learning as a parent that is hard is that my neurodivergence, I'm sorry to always talk about this, but it affects my parenting, because, e.g., I was saying to a friend, oh, it can be really hard to like get my daughter ready in the mornings. Like, we always have such battles with getting dressed, brushing her hair. It can be really hard. Like, I make up games for it, but sometimes she doesn't want to do the games. And she was just like, well, why don't you get that? You can get these little charts and you tick off each thing they need to do, and it really motivates them. And I was like, oh yeah, we had one of them. We used it every day for 3 months. It was brilliant. Then for some reason, we forgot about it forever. And I'm like, this is what I'm wrestling with now, is like trying to have consistency in my life and for my kids. And knowing that actually what I have is like, we're doing it. oh, we'll never do it again. We're having porridge every day. Oh, we've forgotten. Mate, that's the hard part.
Just you mentioning the porridge there was something. Oh, I'm exactly the same, but particularly with meals. Like, I'll be like,
yes!
I'm so bored of what I'm eating. What can I eat? Like, this is all I know how to make. And then I'll suddenly remember, oh no, I made that every day for a year. And
yeah,
that was
for years.
And porridge was one, and these protein kind of, no, these banana and oat pancakes that I'd make
delicious
every morning for ages.
I've made them with an egg.
Yeah, yeah. And then, but then I randomly stopped and I've got all of the, I've got the Ninja blender, I've got my juicer, I've got
sure
all sorts of other things that it's all like, I look over at them and go, oh yeah, I used to use them every single day. And yeah, it's bizarre how those things can be completely all or nothing. Again, it's to reference Blind Boy again, setting backstage with him and having him let me know that stammering comes under neurodivergence has been such
that's
a relief
so
for me, because I've never looked any further into it, but it now makes me allow all of the other weird things I've got and go, no, that's just how my brain is. It's like the fact I will be all in on this food for 4 months and then never again. It's like, right, that's just part of my neurodivergence, and I've kind of not had to go and get any further confirmation on that, because it's like, all right, no, I know I've got it. I know there's
yeah,
something
sometimes
there.
That's a key, isn't it?
Yeah.
Sometimes it's like, for me, it was about, oh, I can actually understand myself now, and now I understand myself better. I'm not fighting against it.
Yeah.
I'm not
the fighting
telling
against
myself
it
it's wrong.
Is absolutely key. I have, and I still have major kind of self-esteem issues, but there's loads of stuff where that I will now accept is just the way I am. It's my neurodivergence. Whereas yeah previously I'd be going, oh, you're such a, stop being so awkward over that. Or stop being, do you know what I mean? Whereas now I can go, no, that's fine. I don't particularly want to socialise all the time, or I want to leave early or whatever else. It's not because I'm a bad person. It's just my brain needs to go and relax for a bit.
And also, even if we're not talking about self-acceptance, it's about as well just learning to be kinder to yourself, isn't it?
Yeah.
Just regardless of, you know, neurodivergence, neurotypical stuff. It's also like, I feel like in the past I was so unnecessarily cruel to myself or harsh, you know?
Accepting, again, to quote one of the best albums of recent years, prioritising pleasure. Because, and it's accepting that. Like, the weirdest example I had of this was last year I went to my cousin's wedding in Italy, and I don't like weddings in general, but this was a beautiful, I really enjoyed it. It was beautiful. Mm. But my genuine happiest moment was when I was in a cab back to my hotel after the kind of prep night thing, because I'd had a lovely time, but I was so happy to be leaving. And it was such a weird one. It's like, it wasn't that I was happy to be leaving because it was shit, it was beautiful. But I knew at that point, I was like, right, no, I've had my lot now. I now want to go back. And it was the perfect timing on it. I didn't stay too long.
Oh,
I didn't leave too early. So I didn't have
you
the
did
guilt.
It right.
So I was just in this cab on my own on my way back to the hotel, just going, this is great. I can't wait to get into my hotel and get some takeaway or something. I've had a lovely time. And yeah. Well, whereas normally I'd be thinking, oh, have I let people down? I was the first person to leave. Has this annoyed people? I was like, no, this is spot on. I can enjoy the pleasure of it.
Yeah. Oh, that's so, in some ways, that's so beautiful. In other ways, it's like, God, social anxiety is so harsh, isn't it?
Yeah.
But like,
yeah,
every other time you're like, well, there's probably a reason that I should be freaking out right now.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, speaking of balance, I wanted to kind of ask you where you are at this stage with your balance of mental health and politics, because you're someone, again, who's been a big inspiration, and we've done stuff together on political events in the past. You're someone who's been a big inspiration for activism for me, but also someone that I've spoken to about how fucking overwhelming that can get. And I know, as said, that, as you mentioned, that particular election, it beat you up a lot and it was a hard one to get through. So where are you now with all that? Are you at a good place? And has parenthood changed any of that? Because again, I've got a few mates who became parents and went, oh yeah, everything goes into a weird perspective because you're keeping humans alive.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. God. So what I would say is, I think I used to be a lot more active politically than I am at the moment. Mm-hmm. I think that I'm really lucky that I have a really great community of friends around me, and they have really similar political sensibilities. And so there are small things that we're able to do for one another that does feel political and personal, like pooling childcare, sharing resources, planning things, help supporting one another, that kind of thing, supporting different political things via each other signposting and stuff.
Or Emma Dabiri's book speaks a lot about the importance of grassroots activism, maybe, or the effectiveness of grassroots activism over larger statements and movements. So making changes in your community that work for your community and supporting your community can have a greater effect than the sometimes overwhelming, oh, we need to march and get this changed immediately kind of thing.
Well, I think it's slightly where I am right now, insofar as what parenting has done for me is like my a lot of my life is lived in the micro, you know, it is just in the household with my kids. And so I try my hardest to not be shy of, I guess, what someone who thought I was terrible would say, indoctrinating my children. What I would say is like educating my children or being honest with my children about what my values are.
Yeah.
And what is fun is being in a community where I've got people that I know have set up a thing called the Red Sunday School, which is like basically a political education project for young people and mimics what they used to be 100 years ago, which were all these kind of non-religious Sunday schools to educate children about like society and politics and stuff. So that's really cool that that exists.
That.
But I would also say, like, I wish I was doing more actions. The thing that gives me lots and lots of joy at the moment is seeing Just Stop Oil and This Is Rigged to a group of people in Scotland who are amazing. Just seeing people doing actions in the same vein that people did 15 years ago or 13 years ago with UK Uncut that I was a part of. And, you know, still seeing these activist groups doing direct action all the time. They're so brave. The circumstances in terms of police powers are so much harder. And I'm so in their awe and I love it. And I love, as a mum, being like, I fully support you with no criticism. Like, I don't want to be going, well, actually, should they be doing this, that, the other? I'm like, they are doing something for a righteous cause, which I agree with. Therefore, whatever they're doing, go for it. I also think the stakes are so high that I think incremental solutions for climate change, the type of which are being ignored, but not even proposed by the government, ignored by the government in Westminster, and like wishy-washed around by the opposition in waiting, they're not going to help us. We do not have time for incrementalism. So it is an emergency. So the people that are shouting, I'm like, thank you so much. But my goal is to do more actions. And also my goal is, when my life is slightly less chaotic, to be more of a consistent volunteer locally, because I like tried to volunteer somewhere and then was like, actually, I'm on tour, so I can't do anything.
Yeah.
So there's a few things like that. But this, I'm sorry, I'm just waffling.
No, you go.
There was one thing I was thinking. The thing that does affect my mental health is just climate change. Every few days you read something about a cataclysmic event that is already happening to human beings and to animals, and it's fucking unbearable.
Yeah.
And the terror of that and the sadness of that is what affects me. And also, I don't think it's unjustified. Like, it's not, oh, this is all in your head, or, oh, you're overreacting. Like, you know, like you see a video of a million fish that are dead, and you can't be like, I'm making a big deal out of this. It's like, And I think that's going to be something that all of us are going to have to learn new vocabulary for, skills for, ways of countering. I already feel desperate to do whatever I can in terms of, on a small scale, of like rewilding and things, joining in with local things. Like, I'm desperate in that way. Mm. But like, when you see so much that is the opposite of what needs to be happening. Like, even just yesterday, I saw in Loch Tay, which is such a beautiful place and such a quiet place.
Yeah.
A lot of it has been bought up by this American company that creates compound luxury communities where multimillionaires can build their own gigantic vacation homes within this sealed compound. Mm. And they've apparently, I don't know for sure, but somebody said they have apparently already got rid of thousands of trees and they've got this like building and
it's depressing.
Things like that. You're like, how do I cope with it? You know? So yeah, I'm sorry. That's like a big Debbie Downer. Like, I think that's the thing we're all going to struggle with most.
I completely agree. And one of my favourite activities at the moment is excitedly backing Just Stop Oil or Extinction Rebellion or whoever else, because they come up so much in conversations with people kind of just starting with, oh, did you see what they did at the snooker? And just before anyone's given their opinion, going, yeah, man, it was so good, wasn't it? And really catching people off guard, because particularly where I'm from, there's such a casual agreeance with whatever everyone else has said. So like, there'll be people that I cross paths with, whether they're friends of the family or whatever else, where it's just a, oh, I've read that it's annoying and they're dickheads, so I'll go along with that. But as soon as you're like, no, it's amazing, isn't it? How cool is that, that they've done no harm to anyone, but they're bringing attention. Yeah, but it's bringing negative attention. Well, we're talking about it and we weren't yesterday, so it's having the effect it's meant
to have. And also, do you feel the older you get, the more you feel a little bit like you can be like, well, I think it's good, so it can't all be bad, can it?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I believe that, so somebody does.
I'm proof. I'm living proof. That
I'm living fucking proof.
I do it on every now and then. I stream on Twitch, and there's been a few times that kind of thing has come up. And you don't obviously react to every comment that comes up, but I think I was streaming when that one happened, the snooker one, and it was instantly like, how great is that? Let's watch it. This is good. Because I want everyone in chat to know that there's not going to be an ounce of, oh, come on, guys. Come on, let them play their game. Come on, let's not disrupt things. It's like, no, I think things should be disrupted. And then,
yes.
I don't know, if people feel it's still a bit too much, I'll happily share that I'm a supporter of, and I was saying this on a podcast I recorded yesterday, I don't think that violent protest should be the first answer, but I don't think it should be off the table either. I think there's a lot of things historically that show we need to take disruptive action rather than simply put posters up or signs up or do tweets. So again,
and also trusting, it's important. If somebody, if power is telling you, like if the newspapers or the government are telling you that the only way to be successful is to do a politician, you might be able to assume that perhaps they do not always have your best interests at heart.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually, I think, deconditioning yourself and being an example of someone who is confidently not just going with the flow of, doing people down, tacitly supporting the government or whatever, is very useful. It's really useful. What is it, killing the cop in your head?
Yeah. And you speak of the kind of the motivations of the media or whatever else. And I'm not a conspiracy theorist on any of that.
Oh, God, me not at all. That's the hard part is to talk about it.
I think the BBC is one of the most important things we've got. I think they're fucking up a lot at the moment. And I think they've got a lot of problems. But anyway, let's not get into that. But I think
With the BBC, a lot of Tories have been put into really high places and positions in there. You know, that's going to affect the way that it's run and things. But also, the BBC is massive. And, you know, CBeebies is the BBC. Like, Six Music is the BBC. There's a thousand different arms of it that, are very precious to us culturally. It's not like this one thing of, like, because BBC News does X, Y, Z, therefore the whole thing is...
But I do think it's worth noting how little reporting we're getting on France at the moment, where the people are regularly rioting because they're not happy with their government and with how they're being told they have to live or be and all sorts of stuff. And I think that's got to be a conscious effort, because over here it's like, oh, there was a protest and it blocked the roads for a day or something. And it's this big thing. It's like, right, no, out there they're literally rioting in the streets because of these things.
And for weeks on end. Yes, you're so right. And also what's funny is people who in one breath will be like, vive la France, and in the next breath will be like, how dare Just Stop Oil's slow walk along the road.
I mean,
what do you fucking want?
I bang on about it all the time, but France has a history of social revolution and we have a history, literally a national anthem that's praising the idea of someone being long to reign over us. So again, it's the difference in our historical makeups there, I think. We're excitedly subservient, as we saw with the coronation and with...
Yes, and this is the thing that kills me, because that is not me. I fucking hate it. And I hate fact that it's so prevailing. Do you know, I think a lot about the fact that... So the English Civil War was essentially the aristocracy replacing... the king, wasn't it? Like, it was Parliament replacing the king, but back then Parliament was largely like very, very wealthy landowners.
Right.
And so it wasn't a real revolution. It was like a change of manager for five minutes. And
it was
the reaction
Twitter or threads.
It was Twitter or threads. And then what happened was the backlash against threads was so great. It was double Twitter forevermore.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a funny one.
Well, but can I say one more thing? Because I think this is like, maybe this is like too wanky, but at that time in the English Civil War, it was Twitter or Threads. But at the same time, you had an explosion of radical printing presses and radical groups like the Levellers, the Lollards. You had all these people who were reimagining society, the Diggers, and they were saying, we should all live in common. We should share. Yeah. The earth is a national treasure, a common treasury for all of us to share. Sorry, it's that song, isn't it? But like...
Beautiful.
At the same time as the disappointment with how shit power and entrenched power is in England, ordinary people were doing incredible, progressive, centuries ahead of its time shit. Ordinary people with nothing, with less than even today when things are so stark. And that is also the history of England. And that's the thing I have to always tell myself when I'm really hating it, is that actually there was always this like core of spirit. And just because power's always been so imbalanced doesn't mean that it's not worth it.
Yeah, I think. Yeah. And again, it's traceable, the impact of that core of spirit. Again, it can be really overwhelming to think, well, we can't actually do anything. I really enjoy Rutger Bregman's Utopia for Realists and his happiness one, I can't remember what it's called, but both of them go through history and show the times that good has won and the impact that good has had. Because it's easy to think, oh, bad always wins in history. It's always the rich. It's always this. It's like, no, that's not the case at all. That's, again, another kind of a myth to hold us all down. But moving on from that, I want to talk about the earth being a common treasury for us all, because I want to talk about swimming in nature. And I'm loathe to use the word wild swimming because I use it a lot and I feel like such a wanker when I use it, because I swim in some lakes. I love it. I love swimming in lakes. I love swimming in the sea. I love swimming in rivers. I think it's the best thing and I think it really impacts you in a way. I started doing it because I got into cold water stuff. So I started doing cold showers. So it was, I'd always do my swims in the mornings, and because it was, I wanted that impact of that shock and that thing that just makes you feel a certain
neurodivergence. Go on. As we go.
No, yeah. Me and Tim Clare talked about it, and he was saying how with cold showers, his description was, I've never felt worse after one. He's like, it doesn't always solve all my problems, but I've never felt worse after one. 90% of the time, I feel better, but I've never felt worse. But I know you're a big fan of swimming. Right. I know you're a big fan of nature.
You never regret a swim.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I'm too excited to talk to you, and I'm sorry I'm interrupting. And it's because I agree with you, and I'm excited.
Do it.
It's the thing of you never regret a swim. I haven't really been able to have many swims this summer, and it's been really stressful.
I'm the same. That's so weird. I'm exactly the same. I was excited to talk about it, and then when I was writing out, I was like, I feel like a fraud. I've been for one like lake swim recently, and that's it.
Oh. You miss it in your bones, eh? I think it's like a very old animal thing. Like, we are like animals that would have just had a dip in the river, you know?
Yeah.
That's the most natural thing. Do you have a favourite out of rivers, lakes and the sea?
It's tough. So the best swims I've had have been in Wales, in lakes, just finding these spots. I've got that wild swimming book I think everyone got. It's a really old one, but it lists places. Yeah, and it says the cleanliness and all that kind of thing. But I was kind of living or staying a lot in Margate for a while, and the natural, the seawater Lido thing there, that became an absolute favourite, because it's just getting up at like 5:30 and having a run along the beach, and then getting in there when no one's about was just an absolute,
that to me is like incredible. I wish I could do that. That is absolutely the pinnacle of living.
Yeah.
And I'm so bad in the mornings, but that's so brilliant.
What are your favourites? Because you must have so much around you up there.
Well, yes, actually. What I still can't get over, and I still can't drive, so it relies on me being with friends, but like 90 minutes drive from me. Within a 90-minute drive radius, there are lakes, rivers, waterfalls, so many spaces that you can swim in that are so beautiful.
Yeah.
Within 20 minutes, there's a little lot in the southwest of Glasgow that you can swim in. It's like so nice. There's a place called Mugduck, which is a country park in the northwest of Glasgow, just. And in it, it's got this lock where people go swimming, and it's like, I love it so much because on one side you have kind of families and ladies with wetsuits and inflatable bags, like that vibe.
Yeah.
And then on the other side you just have teenagers getting stoned, having fires and like squealing. And it's just a very beautiful spot that like, everyone's using it, you know?
I love it.
Everyone's enjoying it in their own way.
There's a park in Beckenham called Kelsey Park. It's near where my nan used to live. And the way the park is, on the bridge over the pond, there's a door. So dogs aren't allowed on one side, basically. And the side dogs aren't allowed on backs onto houses. So you'll see loads of cats chilling in the park on that side and dogs chilling in the park on the other side. And it's always amused me to kind of go, all right, because the cats can go, oh, dogs aren't allowed here. Cool. And they just are looking over the pond at people. But yeah, that's it's a beautiful thing, right? Being in nature and being in water is really, it's quite something.
Yeah, I really think as well, it doesn't take that much to feel that connection. That's the thing I'm really learning, is you don't need to be in a very remote place.
Yeah.
If you can find any sort of... I remember once I did some walks with this guy called Daniel Raven Ellison. It's where I met my friend Beth as well, who's a nature facilitator, does all kinds of different things in nature. And we did this walk and it was through Catford, and I think Croydon was another day. It was through Catford and behind and along this really small strip of river. And he was showing how much green space and nature there is in London and how much of it is... behind, hidden. And we walked along this little strip of river and I'd only seen the other part of it, which is obviously the really built up part of it. And there was the remains of like a very old orchard that perhaps was in somebody's garden. A house no longer exists. I don't know. Mm. There was like a peach tree, an almond tree. There's like four or five different types of fruit and nut tree. And I remember it just being so incredibly affecting to me, just being like, wow, like, this little gasp of the natural world is here, and it's enough to be so moving and important in this space, you know, in this city space. And similarly, just a really quick dip in a little pond and then you're all right again.
And I completely agree. Last summer, and I've not done it this year yet, I was doing night swims in Chalkwall. So just outside Chalkwall train station. And when the tides allow, it's literally, for me, it's like a 30-minute drive. But I'll drive there. I'll swim for 5 or 10 minutes and then drive home again. But I'll feel so good because it's just such a beautiful... It'd be quiet. It would be, you know, it'd just be late enough that people aren't out anymore. And it'd be worth it. Like, I'd
yeah, that's beautiful.
The first time I set off, I was like, oh, this feels stupid that I'm going on my own, half-hour drive at 10 in the evening or whatever. It's like, no, that's all I needed, just to get in there and float for a bit with the moon up. And
And I also think there's something to be said for, like, these experiences in nature on your own, you know? It's not necessarily a socialising experience, although I do love doing it with friends and stuff, but it's actually just, like, about you as a little animal living on the planet, if that doesn't sound too silly.
Floating on my back like a massive otter, just in
the dream.
It's just heaven.
You've got the beard as well. You can really live the part.
I could live it. Well, I mean, I don't want to take up too much more of your time, but we've not talked about your book or your tour. And these are two key things I want to talk about because I'm excited. I've not read the book yet. My reading died in the pandemic. It's really weird. Yeah, I'm trying to get it back, but I've got the biggest pile of to read books. But tell me a little bit about, because I don't know what you mean and want. Sorry, I don't know what you want, what you mean.
Because I don't know
what
you mean and
sorry.
What you don't. Sorry, well, firstly, the title has become a millstone around my neck because everyone struggles with it, and I'm like, I'm an idiot. I should have just called it something simple.
My phone, when I'm making the note, has changed it to I don't know what you mean and want you don't. So I was like, is it? I don't know what you want and mean. Anyway,
I think
I don't know what you mean and what you don't.
Though.
It's
a great way of it is. And some of them are about what I was saying about nature, about people having really, really scruffy, small connections with nature and joy, where like a little crumb of like this woman finds this little wasteland around the back of her flat and sits there and has this really profound experience. There's a girl who has a bike. Her first time on a bike in about 10 years and just has this great little time. And like, it's about small gasps of pleasure. They're all in the first person. They're all people who I think are a bit anxious and overthinking and overfeeling. But there's quite a broad range of them. Some of them are about love and some of them are about parenting and some of them are about politics and dystopia and climate change. And I like to think it's quite a good mix.
I'm so excited to read it, Josie, because I think we're in kind of a weird renaissance of short stories, because it feels like shorts kind of got pushed aside for novels and grander stories and the more kind of lauded areas of literature, I guess. But Limmy had an amazing short stories book, and Blind Boy has as well. And I'm excited to read yours. And it feels like there's this real kind of rush of these short stories that it doesn't, because I think we live in a society now, particularly in the entertainment industry, where anything you write, it's like, oh, could this be a series?
Could this be a memoir?
Oh, you've got a short. Could this be a novel? Could this be this? Could this be a series of books? It's like, no, it is what it is. It's its own little story. I've struggled with that where I've been trying to get scripts made at points where I've written a short that someone loves and they're like, could this be a feature? I'm like, no, it's a short. Like that's what it's meant to be. I can write you a feature, but this is a short. Allow it to be what it's meant to be. So, yeah.
But this is where you need to get better at lying. You'd be like, yeah, definitely, yeah, yeah. And then you just write the feature you want to write. Take the money.
Completely unrelated. I want to kind of wrap up by talking about touring, because I'm really interested in how you tour now. As I've said, I love you dearly. So I jump anytime I see you on a podcast. And I heard you talking on a podcast about the balance of touring that you have now, touring life and family life, what you do now. Because again, a lot of people will put off family life because of work, will be touring and away from their family all the time. But you've kind of gone, no, I can do both. I can make it work.
I'm trying to. I don't know how successful I've been. I think it's meant that instead of doing three months of real solid touring, instead I'm doing like 6 months of like small
chunks.
Bits.
Yeah.
And I think actually it's still 6 months, and that is still a long time, even if you're only away the odd night. Yeah. So I think it's a balance that like me and my partner are both trying to learn to strike, and we haven't yet done it.
Yeah.
But if anything, it's made me think, especially, I guess I'm older, I've been doing this a longer time. I don't mind if I don't tour every year now. And to be honest, I don't mind if I tour every 3 years, as long as hopefully people will still come, hopefully. Yeah. But like, I think that's what will happen is that actually I'll now go into a phase where I'll have 1 or even 2 years off touring again so that I can build up something and be with my kids more, be more at home.
Yeah.
So I think that in the past it would be like tour every year, absolutely never miss a year. And now I'm hoping that it's just slightly more breathing space to be with my kids while they're still young.
It's interesting, isn't it, how again this industry will make you feel like if you take a week off, someone is going to steal your place and take your place and things like that. And I think we're going to see a lot more people realise that's not the case with having to take a year or two off the fringe because of how expensive it is. And like, as an example I tried to come and see you at the fringe last year, but you were sold out all the time. So I couldn't get in.
So mate, again,
it's a good indication of that you've earned that following and you've earned that support.
Well, it's a small rent.
But still, you know, it's beautiful. Like I always love, I put you on there with people like Tim Key and a few others who are the people that if they're available to be seen at the fringe, I will see them. They will be seen, and it's like you've got that nice kind of following there.
I feel so proud of that, and it makes me really. I'm so thrilled that you would think that, especially you would think that. Yeah. It's like amazing to me. But also, do you know what? As well, you're saying about taking time off and someone else will take it, or you'll miss out. The thing that you really learn is, I think, is that so much is beyond your control anyway.
Yeah.
You can be there and ready to work and still not get the work, or you can do a pitch and it won't be the right time for the pitch, or you can just be the right person at the wrong time or the wrong person at the right time, or, you know, it's so much of it is outside your control that you might as well do it in a way that suits you.
I've lucked out in that getting into acting has helped my mental health in a way that it breaks most people, because it's made me accept that there's so much out of my control. Because every time I'm doing a self-tape, like 99% of my self-tapes, I don't beat myself up over at all. I do it the best I can and then go, cool, that's someone else's problem now, kind of thing. I've offered them what I can offer. I might not fit. I might be too tall. I might be too hairy. There's all sorts of other things. It's like, and I think that has helped me in life in general to, exactly as you say there, accept that there's so much that's out of your control. And that was always a big problem for me, particularly in the touring days and that, where it was my own record label and my own music and all of this. It's like, I need to be doing everything. I need to control it all and have this success. Yes.
But it's an illusion of control is what I was going to say.
Yeah.
Because actually, yes, you were the writer performer and you run the label, but you don't have control over everything else, everyone else. So you feel you should be able to control it, but you can't.
Yeah.
And so actually you just have to like do what you can.
Yeah. I think social media might have helped a lot of people of our age in that respect, because we all came onto social media where we had our reach, and then our reach was taken away from us because of algorithms and everything else. Like in the early days, it was like, God, I will post and the people who like me will follow. Then algorithms, that killed that. And it was a year or so of being angry about it, and then just acceptance. It's like, right, cool.
Oh.
I can't do anything about that. It's not mine. It's not in my control anymore.
God, good for you that you even can wrangle with that, though, because it's so unfair.
It's fucking shit, isn't it? But
I just want to say, I'm sorry I'm so excitable. I feel like I've like interrupted loads, but it's thank you for being so kind and so generous to me.
Not
it's
at
lovely
all.
To talk to you.
The complaint I get the most about this podcast is how much I excitedly interrupt people. So we've been on the exact same page today. You're in the right place for it. So
now you're getting your own medicine. Are you coming to Glasgow soon?
Hopefully. My friend B Dolan, who's an amazing rapper, is playing, he's doing a few nights at the Fringe and then his tour starts in Glasgow. So I'm going to try and come up and catch him there because I've got a load of mates up there. So if that happens,
would
I'll
you
give
text
you a shout.
Me? We'll maybe go for a little cup of tea.
100%. I'll drive you somewhere to swim.
Fucking yes! Yes! I'll bring a flask of tea.
Perfect. It's done. Thank you, Joey. So I'm going to let you get back to your day, but it's been an absolute joy.
Oh my God, thanks so much for having me. I love having a rangy chat.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. That was Josie Long. Just wonderful. As mentioned in the chat, Josie's got an amazing book of short stories, Because I Don't Know What You Mean and What You Don't. It's fantastic. And Josie's on tour. So go and catch Josie. And Josie's just wonderful. Just engage with everything that Josie does. It will improve your life, in my opinion. I'll be back next week with another wonderful inspiration of mine. I'll tell you now, it's Lou Sanders. Another conversation that just left me glowing. So you're going to enjoy that next week. We've got loads of good episodes on the way for you. Keep tuning in. Keep showing love. Keep spreading the love. Hopefully I'll see a load of you Thursday, 3rd of August, 7 p.m, twitch.tv/ScroobiusPip. Yo, come ready with your questions. Get it up on the big TV if you can, on the big sound system. We're going to have a little party. All right. I'll see you all soon. Until then, stay safe and stay sane. Ta-ta.